It's a Saturday morning. They come around very, very quickly. Dr. Ross is on the phone. Hello, Ross.
Oh, g'day, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
And lovely to speak with you, as always. Let's start with some listener questions. Deborah is 44, and she says, I've been trying to lose weight, but haven't seen results despite eating healthy and exercising. Could there be a medical reason, and should I get any tests done?
Yeah, look, the typical cause for people not being able to lose weight is they're still taking in more food than they're burning off every day. So calories in, calories burn, and also the mix. They're having more carbs than they should be having. The refined carbs, being, of course, any form of sugar, and also white bread, pasta, potatoes, and rice. And that's the typical cause, and I throw alcohol on top of that. Some people have soft drinks, but it sounds like Deborah's trying to do all the right things. As she's moving into menopause, because there's a very long premenopausal phase, the hormones start to change. It makes it easier to put on weight. So that's probably a factor. Now, in terms of secondary causes of weight gain, they're incredibly rare, the commonest one being an underactive thyroid, and that's an easy test. There's also an easy test to have an overnight fasting cortisol level, and sometimes you can have benign tumours of either the pituitary gland or the adrenal gland that can put too much cortisone into the system, make you gain weight. And also there's a thing called a prolactinoma, which is a small microadenoma or benign tumour of the pituitary gland that secretes prolactin, and that can also be associated with quite significant weight gain. But the underactive thyroid is probably about 10% of the cause. The other two I mentioned, the cortisone secreting tumours and the prolactinomas, are well less than 1% of the cause of weight gain. But as I said, the vast majority is just lifestyle factors. On top of people who are going to menopause, or males going through andropause, and also the insulin resistant gene, which is the gene that occurs in about 30% of Caucasians, 50% of Asians, and 100% of people with darker olive skin, which is why you've never seen a skinny Tongan. I'm not being flippant. They're the world champions of insulin resistance and the world champions of obesity. So when you expose anyone with that gene to Western rubbish, it's very easy for them to put on weight. So what can Deborah do under these circumstances? Well, firstly, realise that when you make any lifestyle changes, it takes months and months and months to see any benefits. So I say it's a bit like an archaeologic dig. You've just got to keep digging and digging and digging until you strike gold. And that may take months and months. And the problem with human beings, they want a quick fix. So people go on a diet, and I wrote a book over 20 years ago called Diets Don't Work, because you go on a diet like you go on a holiday. What happens when you go on a holiday? The holiday stops and the diet stops. And when you stop the diet, the weight just comes back on. And it's all about, I think we spoke about this last week, yo-yo dieting is actually very bad for you. So what the theme of my book was is that you need to have a lifelong commitment to being healthy and focus more on eating less food, eating more natural food, and keeping your exercise up than worrying too much about the scales. And realise that it does take months. So a diet which most people on average stay on for a month or two is just not going to do a damn thing. And let me also make the point about the blockbuster drug of the last decade, the old Ozempic, which many people are now going to as a weight loss drug. And there's an even stronger one now called tirzepatide with the trade name of Mounjaro. And these are all very effective drugs, but all drugs come with side effects. And also when you've achieved your targeted weight, just say your aim is to lose 20 kilos. When you've achieved that 20 kilo weight loss, when you stop, there's a huge rebound weight gain. So I say to anyone who wants to go down that track, A, be aware of the side effects. B, if you want to stop, then what you have to do is, instead of having a weekly injection, for 3 months, have a fortnightly injection, and for the next 3 months, have a monthly injection to wean it slowly out of your system. And realize that it is a quick fix and it is not a long-term solution to anyone's desire to keep their weight down. But it's more the norm than the exception that people gain weight as they get older, for all the reasons I've just said.
Alan says there's a growing trend to use supplements to boost immunity. He wants to know, are there any supplements you recommend, or are they mostly unnecessary if we eat a balanced diet?
That's a really good question, and I'm a great believer in supplements, as you've heard me say over many years. But equally, I take a bucket of supplements all the time, and I'm into my fourth respiratory infection this year, so it hasn't done a lot for my immunity. So what I do, however, is I use spirulina, which is a natural immune stimulant. So it's just a powder that you put in juice every day, and I use that all the time. And there are other things like curcumin and krill, which are very good anti-inflammatories. So, and if you are getting an infection, bumping up your vitamin C, bumping up your garlic, and also bumping up echinacea in some form is also very good for the immunity. But again, regardless of that, some people like myself are very prone to respiratory infections. I've got a friend who's nearly 92. He's never had a flu vaccine in his life, and he's never had influenza. Now, if I don't have a flu vaccine every year, I come down like a ton of bricks with influenza, because it's just the way my immune system is responding to these infections as opposed to someone else's. So you'll often hear people say, oh, I never get a cold, never get a flu. Okay, that's your immune system in that particular way. And I don't think it hurts to get infections, because it's almost challenging your immune system. It's a bit like if you don't exercise, your muscles get floppy. If you don't get a couple of infections a year, your immune system gets a bit weak. So I don't think it's a bad thing to get sick, as long as you're not getting particularly ill.
Peter is 57. He says, how can I tell the difference between normal digestive issues like bloating and more serious conditions like irritable bowel syndrome?
Well, firstly, can I just correct Peter there? Irritable bowel syndrome is not a serious condition. It's just an annoying condition. And 30% of the population have irritable bowel syndrome. And I think the basis of all of this is what we call gut dysbiosis. Now, I think a good analogy here. If you go into a native forest that is untouched by human beings, you see an incredible diversity of plant life and animal life in that forest. As soon as humans come in, they cut the forest down and it loses its diversity. And this is exactly what's happened to our gut over many years of being exposed to Western crap. So when we bring in ultra-processed foods, and when we bring in antibiotics, and when we bring in cesarean births where the babies aren't born down the birth canal, where they pick up a lot of good bacteria, there are so many things that go wrong with our gut in this situation. So I would say to you, the vast majority of people living in the modern world have a degree of gut dysbiosis and defective bacteria living in their colon. So how do you know the difference? Well, it really is the severity of the symptoms. So a bit of bloating, occasional constipation or diarrhea is what you would expect for people that have a degree of gut dysbiosis. So, for example, if you look at the five hunter-gatherer races who are still in existence around the world, and people have examined their stools, they're very large volume stools, they're loose-ish, they don't get constipation. Whereas in our society, we get a lot of bloating, abdominal cramping, sometimes constipation, sometimes diarrhea, which is all manifestations of gut dysbiosis, which then can lead to the more significant symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome. What Peter should be more concerned about are the more serious disorders of the gut, such as inflammatory bowel disease, which is Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, and the less common microscopic colitis. There's also reflux, which affects around 20% of the population. So people get heartburn and indigestion when they eat and don't feel particularly good after a meal. Gallbladder disease is incredibly common. 25% of people over the age of 45 have a degree of gallbladder disease. And the very, very common diverticular disease, which can give you pain down the left side of your tummy. So it's the last bit of the colon draining into sigmoid colon, that bit I was just described. You get little blowouts in the lower colon because often people leave off going to the toilet. They don't empty their bowels when they should be emptying their bowels. They don't break wind when they should be breaking wind bread, to be a bit indelicate there. And that can increase the pressure in the lower colon and cause these little blowouts in the wall. They don't blow out all the way through, but you get little pockets in the bowel that can get infected. So we call it diverticular disease, going on to diverticulitis when it gets infected. So there's a whole lot of different things, but I think symptoms are really our ticket into the system. And if the symptoms are disturbing you, you really need to have them checked.
Let's do some topics. Ross, irregular sleep patterns. even with enough nightly sleep, significantly increase the risk of major cardiovascular events like heart attack and stroke. Researchers found that maintaining a consistent sleep schedule may in fact be more important for heart health than just the number of hours that you sleep each night.
Yeah, this is a study out of a thing you and I have spoken about a lot, the UK Biobank. So just for people who haven't heard of the UK Biobank, it's about 500,000 people that have been studied in various guises over the past 20 years or so, looking at their lifestyle, looking at their medications, looking at their diseases, and some genetic markers as well. So in this particular subgroup of the UK Biobank, just under 72,500 people aged between 40 up to about 80, they gave them sleep trackers and activity trackers to see how good their sleep was and when they went to sleep. And as you mentioned, that the dose of sleep we suggest for people is somewhere between seven to eight hours a night. And people who do that, that's as good for you as not smoking. But what they found, if people vary their sleeping time, so some nights they might go to bed at 9, some nights they might go to bed at midnight, even if they're getting 7 to 8 hours, when you vary your sleeping so badly, the very irregular sleepers had a 26% increased risk for major cardiac events like heart attack or stroke, and moderately irregular sleepers an 8% increased risk. So you say, well, why does this happen? It's felt that the reason that this is happening is because you're mucking around with the biologic clock. So there's some studies to show, for example, the day after daylight saving starts, you increase the risk for a heart attack about 25%. Now, that doesn't mean a quarter of people have a heart attack. It means if the risk for a heart attack is 1%, that goes up to 1.25%, which is a 25% increased risk. So it's really only the people who are at very high risk for heart disease, who then lose an hour's sleep, they're the ones that have the problem. It's not the rest of us who are pretty healthy. But it is saying that if you start mucking around with the circadian rhythm, you can then get some problems, and this is where we should be having a regular sleep pattern. And the other thing, Brent, is that 70% of people are what we call larks, which means go to bed early, wake up early. That's their genetically primed sleep pattern, whereas 30% are night owls. They prefer to go to bed late and wake up late. So you've got to find which genetic features suit you and live to that. Now, our society really is geared for larks because we have 9-to-5 jobs. We've got to get up at 6, 7 o'clock to get ready and be at work at 9, whereas it's more the musicians and the restaurateurs and people who have jobs that are in the evening are more the night owls.
Carpal tunnel syndrome. That's a condition caused by pressure on the median nerve in the wrist. It often requires physical therapies or surgery for relief. But a recent study suggests that kinesio taping in combination with traditional treatments can effectively reduce pain and improve hand function in mild to moderate cases. Firstly, Ross, what is kinesio taping?
Yeah, it's a particular type of taping to the wrist that physios do that tend, for some reason, I'm not sure how it works, but it pulls the tissues off the median nerve. So if you look at the palm of your hand, where your wrist meets the palm of your hand, there's a thing called the carpal tunnel, which is where the median nerve, right in the middle, is where the median nerve goes through and supplies your hand. So carpal tunnel is manifested typically by people waking up with quite significant pain in their hands, numbness, and if it's really bad, if there's a lot of compression of the median nerve, you see the muscles just melt away. So it is a serious condition, and it's typically treated when it's very severe with surgery. So there's a localized, almost laparoscopic surgery that hand surgeons are now doing that's very effective. But in this study of only 27 people with mild to moderate carpal tunnel syndrome, aged between about 20 up to 65, they taped them for 3 months, and they found that this particular taping method, which physiotherapists can do, was highly effective for relieving the symptoms of carpal tunnel. But if your carpal tunnel is really bad, it's best to go off and see a hand surgeon and get it fixed up.
Seed oils such as sunflower and corn oil are commonly used in cooking and processed foods, but they've become a topic of debate. Some claim these oils contribute to health issues due to their omega-6 content and refining process, while others highlight their potential benefits, like improved cholesterol levels and reduced heart disease risk when used in moderation. So given these conflicting views, Ross, what's your perspective on their role in a healthy diet?
Yeah, look, I prefer, I mean, Robert Kennedy Jr., who the Donald may be using his health guru, which is a bit of a worry, because he's a very strong anti-vaxxer and has a few unusual beliefs about medicine. But he's come out and saying that Americans are being unknowingly poisoned by these seed oils. So I think he's probably going over the top. But there are some scientific arguments behind what he's saying, because it's exactly what you said. The omega-6 oils in things like sunflower oil, corn oil, rapeseed oil, grapeseed oil, canola oils, those sort of things. Those omega-6, if you have too many of them, you can then generate a lot of pro-inflammatory chemicals that can have some problems. But the biggest issue is in people who use these sort of oils and then reheat them, because they're creating a lot of these trans fats, which are very, very dangerous and a major cause of vascular disease. But interestingly, I say, look, if there was nothing else to use, well, by all means, use them. But what is the best oil with the greatest evidence base? Of course, it's extra virgin olive oil that has none of this stuff in it. So you can just forget about all this stuff and just use extra virgin olive oil. It has a huge evidence base. It's a major component of the only diet that has any evidence base to it, which is the Mediterranean diet. So why even bother with this argument about whether we should or shouldn't be using seed oils? Just use the oil that you should be using. Extra virgin olive oil.
Researchers have discovered that healing the gut can improve long-term recovery for stroke patients. Their study shows that while brain treatments help in the short term, fixing gut damage can reduce inflammation and brain harm, leading to better overall recovery and lowering the risk of conditions like dementia, Ross.
Yeah, you see, because we're now saying the gut is the second brain. And the nerve supply to the gut is extraordinary, and there is certainly a strong gut-brain axis. And we're saying now that probably over 90% of modern diseases have a link to gut dysbiosis, which is what we were talking about with the question from Peter before. But this particular study showed in people that had a stroke, if you introduce a particular chemical called insulin-like growth factor, not to the brain, but to the gut, you heal what we call a leaky gut, reduce all of the inflammatory chemicals that are being released into the bloodstream for people who have a leaky gut after a stroke because of the link between the gut and the brain, then you actually markedly improve cognitive impairment and recovery from the stroke by fixing the gut up. So this is not standard clinical practice. This is just a trial that they looked at all these things, but I think it's a really interesting concept.
There's a new nasal spray, Ross. It's been developed, and it may help slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease by reducing brain inflammation and clearing harmful protein buildup. If proven effective in humans, they say it could delay Alzheimer's by up to 15 years.
Yeah, well, they've only trialled this in mice with strong promise, and there are these poor mice that have been genetically primed to develop Alzheimer's disease. So they took these mice at about 3 months, and they gave them this particular nasal spray that is made from what we call stem cell extracellular vesicles. The name doesn't really matter. But they sprayed it up the mice nostrils and then put them through a maze soon over the next few months, and just to see how they're much better on getting through a maze. So that's how they tell mice's or the mouse's cognitive function by how well they can make it through a maze. Then they sacrificed the poor buggers and had a look at the different parts of the brain that are very much affected by Alzheimer's disease. And they found that when they gave them this nasal spray, there was much better function in those areas of the brain as opposed to the mice that weren't given the nasal spray. So it hasn't been trialled in humans yet. And let me say, what happens in animals doesn't always translate to human beings, but it's still very promising stuff.
Recent studies show that drinking around 8 cups of water a day can help with weight loss. It can prevent kidney stones, reduce migraines, urinary tract infections, and lower your blood pressure. The findings highlight the simple yet significant health benefits of staying hydrated.
Yeah, well, see, I was one of those people who was always very skeptical about this suggestion we should be having 6 to 8 glasses of water on top of our normal fluid intake, because I felt that people who did that just spent half the day in the bathroom emptying their bladder. But this study looked at 18 randomized controlled clinical trials and showed exactly what you're talking about there: weight loss, better treatment of kidney stones, migraine headaches, diabetes management, urinary tract infections, and it lowers your blood pressure. So I still haven't sort of gone for the water fountain after I read this study, but it is saying that maybe this thought that we should be having 6 to 8 glasses of water is a good thing for your health, especially if you're after one of those health benefits. I mean, for example, kidney stones is not due to people who run around dehydrated. That precipitates the kidney stones in people who are genetically predisposed to having kidney stones. So 90% of kidney stones are what we call calcium oxalate stones, and people who produce kidney stones have what we call hyperoxalate urea, which means that they just make so much more of this oxalate substance in their urine and binds with calcium and can very easily make a stone. And I've got to say, anyone who's had a kidney stone, as far as I'm concerned, I've never had one, but anyone who has a kidney stone, it should be one per customer, because it is the most painful visceral pain on the planet. So it's the king of visceral pain. Now, when I say visceral pain, if someone rips off your right arm, obviously that's going to be more painful. But having a kidney stone is numero uno for abdominal pain, chest pain, whatever. The kidney stones are the worst pain you can have, closely followed by gallstones, and then closely followed by going through labour. And probably after that, a bad heart attack. So you don't want a kidney stone. So anything that can help prevent it, such as having your 6 to 8 glasses of water a day, I certainly condone it.
We say here 8 cups of water a day, but if you have a total amount of fluid, suggesting a cup is maybe 250 ml of water, cups of tea and a cup of coffee can be included in that. Is that correct?
Not really. I think they're suggesting water rather than fluid. Because the problem with tea and coffee is the caffeine is somewhat diuretic, so it can make you a bit dehydrated, as can alcohol. So I think they're really saying you should be bumping up some extra water, maybe not 8 glasses a day, but certainly 4 to 6 would be a good thing.
We'll leave it there, Ross. Thank you again. We're getting close to Christmas, so appreciate you joining us each and every Saturday. I believe next Saturday is our last Saturday chat for 6 or so weeks while you take a break over the Christmas New Year period.
Absolutely, mate, but I certainly, as always, look forward to speaking to you next Saturday.